Happy Thursday, everyone. You know, it's a little bit of a potpourri Thursday. We're going to be discussing a bunch of great stuff here on Tech Strong Gang. We've got open source business models, observability, what's going on at Broadcom, and even a little bit about how AI is affecting the job market. All that and more here on Tech Strong Gang. Hey, I'm Alan Schimmel, CEO of TechStrong Group here in Boca Raton at our TechStrong headquarters studios for this Thursday edition of TechStrong Gang. The rest of the gang for today is remote. Let me quickly introduce them to you. First of all, joining us from all the way out in L.A., our good friend Bob Resselman and gang member. Hey, Bob, welcome and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Just moving west to east, we'll next stop in San Angelo, Texas, where our editor, Amanda Razzani, resides. And Amanda, welcome.
Hello, happy to be here.
Thank you. And then making a rare appearance from his haunts up in New York, our chief content officer, Mike Vizard. Hey, Mike, welcome.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
Good. All right. So let's dive into what we're doing today. I'm going to audible a little bit. I want to start off with an article that I came to my attention this morning out of the Inc. magazine. And it was basically a analysis that was done of job listings, not really gig listings, let's call them, on Upworks, right? Because the premise is that contracting jobs are much more sensitive to changes in job market before we see it in real, you know, full-time positions. And so they looked at what jobs have been changing or what job listings have gone up or down with the rise of AI. And surprisingly, as you may or may not think, video editing, videographers have not really changed in terms of the amount of listing. Coding, both front-end, back-end, web coding, has not really changed in the amount of listing. So what has really changed? Well, sorry for all of our TechStrong writers out there, but it seems writing gigs are down by 33%. Now, that's sizable. That's sizable. I'm going to throw it out to you. We've got three folks who write for us here. What do you guys think?
So my question is this just the canary in the coal mine and everybody else will be seeing the same thing shortly? Because if I look back at these AI platforms, they're very text-driven and the easiest place to apply them is naturally writing. I think we're going to see more developers using these tools to write code. So I don't know if people are contracting development work anyway because they don't have developers on staff, but that's always been an issue in the development space because a lot of people prefer to hire developers as contractors and maybe they're using the AI tools. In video, it's still early days, but I think that's all coming. We've all seen at least demos of things that people are working with. Atlassian is just today showing a tool that they came out with, which lets mere mortals edit videos before they send them out asynchronously to show somebody how something works. And that may reduce the need for videographers. Who knows? I just think the whole thing is constantly evolving. I'm not sure that a lot of the writing gigs that people were posting were high value writing gigs. So, you know, we'll see where we go. Amanda, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I love Upwork. That is how y'all found me, is through Upwork. So, and it's a great platform. And I have to say, whereas I do love ChatGPT and other AI tools as tools, I feel that there's still a lot to be said from the human and creative element that you're just not going to get from AI. So I think there's a lot of writers, they're not going to be able to be mimicked or copied at this time by AI. Now, maybe down the road, yes, but I can still often tell the difference between something written by an individual and the AI. So I think there's a long road ahead before it could just totally replace the human element.
Bob, care to weigh in?
Allow me to weigh in. Yeah, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. I mean, we knew this was going to happen. As Amanda said, I think one thing that AI is not really good at yet is telling a bad joke, let alone telling a good joke. And that just goes back to voice. There's still, when you read an article by an experienced writer, you want the article to be engaging. Okay. And so AI is still having a little problem with that. So the people that live in that area, which I do, I mean, I'm still getting writing work. I haven't had a problem. But again, I tell bad jokes, so people seem to want that. That hasn't worked. But again, I'm not surprised. Where it's really going to impact other than writers is I'm waiting for, because I live out here, I live 5 minutes from Sony Studios, is where it's going to start hitting, commercial television and commercial movies. And we saw that. I was watching Halo. Right, and if you look at Halo, there's only maybe six people that are principals in that, and everything else is graphic generated content based on the video game. And we're going to start seeing more of that, and it's been happening with animation. So to wrap it up, I'm not surprised. Am I sad about it? Yeah. What are all the people that are studying to becoming writers in college or technical writers going to be doing with their life? Well, there's still need for electricians. What can I say?
I would love to get some insight into what kind of writing gigs we're talking about. Because when I look at Upwork, there's a lot of these technical writing projects, where it's basically, here, take my documentation and turn it into something that can be considered a document that somebody would use for training or whatever. Frankly, AI might be better at that stuff. So we'll see.
Well,
yeah, I think it's better at dry content, like dry, totally informational content. Yeah. But anything above that, no.
If it's accurate. I've had trouble with AI accuracy. I still do a lot of coding, I tend to use other platforms other than ChatGPT, but I'll say, okay, show me how to do XYZ. Show me how to use generics and TypeScript in this situation. And I get back an answer and it looks good. And then you try it and you realize it doesn't work. So obviously it didn't plagiarize the right code. So there's still that issue. You're still going to need that need for quality assurance, particularly in complex technical writing. Like, would I really want AI writing the technical documentation for doing micro heart surgery? I'm wondering about that.
All right. Alan, you started this mess.
Yeah, no, I was interested to, because there's some self-dealing here, right? We all have an interest in this. Look, Mike, I don't think you're wrong. I think writers are not the tip of the spear. They're at the tip of the spear of this AI functionality, because it is probably the easiest thing to do is just say, hey, write me an article, or write me this, or write that, or rewrite this, or edit that. I don't think things like video editing and so forth are far behind, or image editing. And quite frankly, I don't think coding is that far behind that either. These are going to be just one domino after the next falling. I will tell you, yes, sometimes you could, more than sometimes, oftentimes you could definitely tell if something was written with AI or had, has AI fingerprints on it. That doesn't necessarily make it better or worse than a human written one. I've used it to write emails and other things where it does a much better job than I would have. But anyone who sits there, and we've had this discussion. That's why I brought it up. We've had this discussion on Tech Strong Gang. We're going to 10X everyone. It's not going to cost anyone their jobs. Yes, there are going to be some jobs that are lost to AI. I think we've got to face that. And whether they're in writing or video editing or coding or lawyers or doctors or whatever, that's the fact. But it's still going to create more jobs than it takes. And I guess we'll leave it at that. What do you think?
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to the first official block of the show.
Sure.
So we have an article on DevOps.com talking about what's going on in the open source world with all these business models that are shifting around as companies try to figure out how to make some money. And Alan, I know you've been tracking this space, so what's your perspective on what's going on here and what should people be
I've been tracking the open source world for 20 something years. I've been involved in it for a very long time, especially open source security. The issue is the open source model. For many, many years, all we ever heard was the only company that really did well in open source was Red Hat. Well, then the whole cloud native movement came along and the foundational era of open source. And we started seeing a lot of companies, you know, with what were considered successful business models. MuleSoft, for instance. We can name more. But I think what's gone on here is funded in an era of free money, low interest rates and all. You can get away with a certain amount. But when the going gets tough and the bean counters get involved, a business model that says 98% of the people who use your software aren't going to pay you for it is a tough pill to swallow. It's a tough road to hoe. And so I think several companies, as laid out in this article on DevOps.com, including HashiCorp and even Red Hat, the open source, darling itself, have realized that, okay, we're going to still let people get their hands on software, but we're going to have to keep some of the goods behind a paywall. And I call it a paywall because that's what it is, right? You're going to have to be a commercial customer to get some of the functionality, some of the access that you may want. And it may be that, look, not everyone wants that functionality. Maybe only 20% do or 15%. But that's still a hell of a lot better than the 3 or 4% in the average kind of open source business model who wind up paying for software. I think we're going to see more and more of this.
Bob, will people go elsewhere or will they pay for the fee?
I don't know. Again, the question is who is open source meaningful to, right? And so when you look at something like, Red Hat or something like Kubernetes is terribly complex, right? So somebody off the street, are they really going to fork Kubernetes and create a better Kubernetes? That's a hard one. So it really is, where's the impact going to be? Is it going to slow down overall innovation? That's going to be an interesting take. Will the product life cycle start getting longer again? Will we be, instead of taking 6 months to release a major piece of software, is it now going to go back to taking 2 years because of all the corporate administrativity that goes with it? Is it not bad PR is not the right word, but is it the end of an era? Might be. It might be, but as Alan says, people got to make a buck. Yeah. People got to make a buck. And there's only so many graduates, postdoctoral students out there that have the time to actually create, complex software and put it out there for free.
You just hit it on the head, Bob. When you have companies producing open source software as a business model, you can't take the business out of the model.
Right.
If it's a school project or a postgraduate's degree and a labor of love, that's another story. But Mike, to your point, I don't think people are going to say, well, now that they're charging me, I'm going to go look for something else. There is nothing else. They're going to pay if they need that functionality, right? Mm-hmm. Very few people are capable of saying, screw that, I'll take the open core, open source, fork it, modify it, build off of it. They don't. Most people use open source the same way they use, commercial software, which is they take the wrapper off and go.
This whole conversation is playing out in the AI space, Amanda. So, what are you saying?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think it comes down to any resource that you're initially offered for free. If it is valuable enough, like Bob said, you're going to be willing to pay for it. So we can see that example simply with OpenAI and ChatGPT. It was free. Everybody loves it. Everybody's willing to pay for it, including myself. And I think that's the way it's going to go because it costs money to keep these projects going, a lot of money. And so I think you're going to see less and less open, of the open stuff because, they need to make an income.
Yeah, but I think the price point might drop because there are open LLMs for just about every function you can think of these days, and ISVs are just going to drop those things in their applications, and they'll probably charge something for that privilege. But I don't think it's going to be, $20 to $40 a month to Microsoft for every user kind of thing.
We'll see. It'll
be interesting to see how the VCs take this. I mean, right now, if you go to, you say, okay, I have a great new database and I have a great new idea for a database, you know, and I need 40 million to start, and you go to the VCs and the VC says, okay, great new idea for a database, 40 million to start. How are you going to distribute it? Well, I'm going to open source it. Okay. And I'm going to build a community around it. And then the VC says, no, you're not. Right. Then it becomes an interesting dynamic. Right now, there's a lot of VCs that'll still buy into it, but how many are going to stop and say, no, we only support private code now. That'll be interesting to watch.
All right. Alan, last word on this particular subject?
I think I said my last word. You can't take the business out of the business model anymore. To Bob's point about the end of an era, look, I called it the foundational era of open source, where you had the Linux Foundation and CNCF and all of these not-for-profits that were shepherding these projects. And oftentimes, there was a bevy of commercial companies that were, profiting by letting the Linux Foundation deal with the cost and the complexity of maintaining an open source project. I'm not saying that's not viable. It is viable still. But, for the business to stay in it, there's got to be profit. And the model right beforehand was just too razor thin. So I think that's the world we're going to, and so be it.
All right, folks, good. We're going to come back in a minute. I would just point out one last thing on this subject. 80% of the software we're using today has got open source components in it from somewhere. So if we have to start paying for all that, the price of software is going to go through the roof. All right. We'll be back in a minute.
All right.
All right, folks, we're back and we're talking about observability, which in a lot of cases is starting to feel like too much of a good thing. The issue is that as we start to apply these observability platforms to collect everything from traces and metrics and logs that we're storing in a massive amount of information, and all these modern cloud native applications have microservices and each one kicks off a boatload of data that you're supposed to collect. The issue is organizations are not collecting all that data because it's too costly to store it all. So they are collecting it, shall we say, intermittently. In other words, basically too expensive to analyze the data. So they stop collecting the data, which kind of defeats the purpose of observability. We're seeing everybody from Sumo Logic to startups like Observe change their licensing terms for storage to kind of address this issue. But Alan, I'd love to get your take on what you think is going on here, but it seems like we've reached a point where observability is being held back simply around cost issues.
You know what? A rose by any other color would smell as sweet or cost as much. This is something that is plagued, you want to call it log collection, data collection. I mean, it was, Splunk, for as great a business as Splunk was, there was a whole ecosystem of players underneath Splunk who would collect and store the data cheaper than Splunk could or would. The problem with, as observability has given us the ability to observe more, right? To gather more data, to make more analysis and more observations, the more part of it costs more money. And, you know, it's interesting. I've seen some companies, and I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, some of the startups that actually do observability in a more efficient way. They look at the data as it's being collected, take what they think, you know, what their algorithms tell them is necessary, and purge the rest so that you wind up only having to analyze, store a tenth of everything. But there are some people who just do want to store everything because they may need it for forensics or whatever, you know, further down the road. But fundamentally, observability is a big data play. You can't do observability without it. And big data costs money. You know, there's been this kind of Moore's law where storage of data, the cost of storing data has gotten cheaper and cheaper and cheaper depending on what kind of, you know, recall and how fast it is and all of that. But as that has come, it hasn't kept pace with the amount of data that we want to store, right? We want to store everything. And so there's been a data explosion. And so at some point, I think people are going to have to make some choices about what they want to store, what they want to observe, and how long they want to keep data.
Bob, we've been talking about monitoring forever and a day, and arguably observability has always been a core tenet of DevOps. But in your mind, do you make a distinction between observability and monitoring and what people have been doing historically as a developer? And what are you looking for?
What am I looking for? I'm looking for data that makes sense. Okay. And you know, the joke, when I got this topic yesterday, I was looking at saying, well, you know, what could I say about this? Well, you know, data everywhere, but you nary a log entry that makes sense. So going back to what Alan says, we know we have to look at stuff coming in and is this meaningful to me and should I store it? And another part of me is saying, you know, cheapers. You know, I bought my first hard drive back in 1980, and I paid $200 for like something like 20 megabytes. And now I can run down the Best Buy and buy a terabyte for $100. I mean, give me a break. Oh, tell me your tale of woe of storing a terabyte of data too much. I mean, come on. Really?
But Bob, it's all relative, right? Yeah. Because back then, 20 megabits of data, look, you can install your OS, your applications, and still have a bunch left over to store your data. Today, I personally go through a terabyte, well, not quite a terabyte, but I go through a couple of hundred gigs. Just want my own personal photos and videos and stuff like that, right? There is this inexplicable law, you know, like how gas will fill the volume of its container.
Yeah.
Give us a container for data and we'll fill it.
Right. You know? The growing desktop, you know, the chunk on your desktop is proportional to the size of your desktop. However, there's not a lot of people logging video that I know about. Right. There's not a lot of people logging audio that I know about, but I could be wrong. So we're still back to fundamental data structures.
Yep.
Right. And so I'm back to, you know, I'm back to my Crimea River argument.
They estimate that 40% of all storage on the internet shortly will be medical data, things like MRI films. And so forth. And that does cost money. But let's take it back to observability, though, because observability is not, let's call it, general purpose data storage. Observability is, it's usually log files, right? And those kinds of things. You know, it was always, if you ever speak to people like Splunk customers, this was always a thing, right? How it, you know, the cost for Splunk was directly proportional to how much data you had it analyze.
All right. So now you've come to the little theme for the show. Are the business models of these companies fundamentally flawed because they're all following the Splunk model where, you know, basically we're going to charge for storage and data and this will be great. We'll get them coming and going and it'll be fabulous. And people started rebelling against the Splunk model, especially in the cloud era. I think a lot of these companies just got to find a different business model that doesn't include storage or buries the cost of storage somewhere in a way that I don't see it or feel it.
I think I said it right in the beginning. I've seen companies that are, there's this whole ecosystem of companies that are looking at doing observability in real time without having to store and then analyze the data later. I think ultimately what it's going to come down to is we're going to see the stratification of data. Some log data is going to be very important, and I'm going to want that close by in a very fast data. Other stuff I'm going to archive, and I may never use it for a year or two, and then after 2 years I'll purge it. Other stuff I'm going to analyze in real time, and it'll never make it to the other side of where I store the data and analyze it again later. I'll just have like, or do we come up with like lossless or lossy compression of data, where we have the shadow of the data but not the actual full data? I think all of these things will, you know, the market is the mother of invention here. So you're going to have all of these kinds of options depending on how important certain data is toward you, for you in your business model.
I think as AI is implemented with these automation tools, we will have more and more of that ability to filter through that data and then have less data that has to be stored. And as it, you know, just like with any technology, the cost will go down over time.
I'm not sure I agree with this. And here's my cynicism about that particular conversation, because I've heard it before. And yet we need all this data to train the AI models that we're going to apply to observability. So I'm going to get charged for the data that I'm going to use to let you store to train your AI model that you're going to bill me for on the back end so I can be better at my gig. I think the cost of the data should be wrapped up into the cost of the AI model usage, and don't nickel and dime me to death is what I keep coming back to about these things. So I'm kind of agreeing with Bob here. I feel like these guys are just nickel and diming everybody, and they're trying to pick your pocket going in and out the door.
Yeah. Fair and enough. Also there's, I mean, you know, pay me now, pay me later. Okay. You're going to save on storage costs, but all that data analysis is compute cost.
Yeah.
So that's not going to go away. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, there's a good argument to be made that the compute cost might actually outweigh the storage costs. We don't know. We have to do some measurement. But I was watching the movie BlackBerry the other day, mm-hmm. and they were talking about the demise of BlackBerry. And they said, why? The guy goes to AT&T and says, why won't you support us anymore? He said, well, the problem with the minute is it's only a minute. We no longer want to sell time. We want to sell data rate.
Yep.
Right. And so what are we selling here? That becomes interesting. If I'm selling storage, I'm selling storage, right? Okay, you know, then I'm selling storage.
But if I'm selling analysis, it's analysis, right? And that's compute. You're right.
Yeah, if I'm
You're 100% right. It's going to be interesting. Hey, let's take a break here on TechStrong Gang. We'll be back with our next block in a moment.
DevOps.com is the number one online destination for DevOps education and community building. DevOps.com covers all aspects of DevOps, including DevOps best practices and tools, DevOps culture, DevSecOps, business impact, continuous testing, continuous delivery, and more. DevOps.com has the largest collection of original DevOps content, featuring breaking news, blog posts, podcasts, and more. Visit www.devops.com to learn more. DevOps.com, where the world meets DevOps.
All right, we're back here on the gang, and let's move into our next block. You know, look, there were a lot of people who were scratching their head when Broadcom, one of the premier hardware vendors in the world, first got into the software game, right? They bought CA, was a big prize for a couple billion bucks. I think it was $6 billion, $4 billion, something. They bought CA. Since then, though, they've bought a bunch of other software plays, VMware obviously being the big one there, that they've recently digested, ingested, and now, you know, what's the right word? I'm trying to think of a word that's a little politically correct, but they finished digesting it, and this is what happens after you digest your food. But anyway, they've also bought quite a few security companies, right? They Carbon Black, Symantec, and then there was DevSecOps, another security functionality in sundry places throughout these acquisitions. Sometimes, you know, Hawk and Gang of Broadcom have been very sharp in cutting these businesses, reorganizing them, selling the ones that don't make sense. I don't always see the rhyme or reason to it. I'll admit that to you. However, he's a lot richer than I am. And, you know, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt as well as the folks at Broadcom. Most recently now, they have announced, and this is an article over in Security Boulevard, that they're merging the Carbon, the existing remaining Carbon Black business with the, I guess it was the half of the Symantec business that they bought. To create a security unit. And of course, given Broadcom's MO lately, people are wondering, is this foreshadow then packaging this up for a sale? Because maybe they don't want to be in that security unit, in that security business. I don't know. It sounds pretty logical to me. Gang guys, gang members, what do you think?
I'm going to assume that they are as smart as you're describing, and I think they know full well the implications of the moves that they're making, and they must have modeled that out, because I don't think they're just, I hope not, at least randomly just doing stuff that looks good on paper. But there's a lot of turmoil out there now. I mean, there's a lot of customers of Carbon Black that want to know if they're essentially being abandoned and where they might wind up down the road. There's a lot of unhappy VMware customers that don't like the new licensing terms, because everything now is a subscription and there's no perpetual license on premise. And as we both know, most of that VMware stuff is still running on premise. And that gets people thinking about what are their options at the very least. I'm not sure who's benefiting ultimately from this, but I would look at the latest Nutanix financial results are pretty startling, where they're up like 40% for the quarter. Some of that is driven clearly by VMware angst. I think a lot of workloads might move to the cloud and on other platforms. So you might see Microsoft, AWS, and Google benefit, because a lot of people will accelerate a transition that they were kind of thinking about longer term. But from the conversations you have with everybody, everybody's sitting around on their hands going, I don't know what to do. So they start hedging bets left, right, and center. And I think we've seen this before, Bob, but it's at a level of unprecedented scale, shall we say, because it seems like everybody's involved in it all at once.
Well, maybe. One of the things I did find encouraging about your analysis of the acquisitions is that there is a lot of language in there that we're going to put money in. Okay, we're going to put R&D money in, and we're going to sort of develop this product line. Those are words. I mean, you know, show me the checkbook. So my anxiety around any of this type of activities is leverage buyout, right? Where we just buy the company and dissect it up, or we buy VMware and we just start chopping VMware up and selling it off. That's not what I'm seeing. That's not what I'm supposing is going to happen here. So that's actually good news in a way that it's just not a grab. You know, consolidation. Yeah, I mean, consolidation's been going on. It's beyond me. I couldn't. If you were to say, you know, Bob, we want to hire you to go out and buy two security companies, Symantec and Carbon Black, and put them together in a compatible, profitable way, how would you do that? I have no idea. That's just a very complex undertaking that I couldn't even imagine. I couldn't even, you know. And so, I guess above my pay grade a little, I'd be interested to know what has to happen in order to make that work. And why somebody would contemplate that, and operationally what that means on the ground. If I'm an engineer, that'd be interesting to me.
Here's the part that always leaves me scratching my head about VMware in general. I got to remember all the people who have owned VMware over the years, but the amount of time that it's been an independent company is small in comparison to the fact that it's been owned now by Broadcom. Then it was Dell before that, and it was EMC before that, and it never seems to be able to stand alone on its own two feet for whatever reasons that baffle me. And I don't know if that's because the business model is flawed. See, we're back to that term again. Or if there's something else that goes on inherently with VMware and hypervisors that just never allow them to kind of get to the level of scale where they could successfully compete as a standalone company. Alan, I know you've been watching this space. What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's two issues here we're discussing. The article is about security. You're talking about VMware. VMware has always been a redheaded stepchild, right? It was bastardized out of EMC. EMC got bought by Dell. It became part of Dell. Then they spun out and Dell took it back and then they spun out. And it's had that. It's had that, though, because for a little side project, it became a damn big thing. It almost single-handedly helped usher in the cloud era. And the technology was always really good. Right? Unfortunately, I think it was hamstrung more by business leaderships and stuff like that, and that it was always somehow attached to EMC and then to Dell. I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, quite frankly, we've discussed this on the gang. I think Dell accounts for 40% of EMC, of VMware sales still, right? Because Dell sells it as their big channel. So, and I think Broadcom recognizes that without Dell as the channel there, what do they got? The same thing here for security, right? When we talk about Symantec, this isn't Big Yellow, John Thompson security from 15, 20 years ago. That what they bought was it the consumer brand or the business Symantec business? And it wasn't the digital certificates, it was a sliver of the Symantec business. Carbon Black really helped in terms of backup and stuff like that. But, you know, and in that regard, they're a security company, but, you know, they didn't have the Symantec name within security. I do think that, you know, given Broadcom's past experience and practice, they're packaging this up. They'll sell it to a PE or something, right? Who will come in here and there's probably, you know, the one thing, security is hot as always, but the one thing about this kind of security business is they throw off good cash. And so someone will buy it for the cash flow, right? This isn't about protecting critical infrastructure or something like that. This is a cash flow play. And there'll be someone to buy it off. And that helps them pay down, I guess, some of the debt they incurred in buying VMware for however many billions of dollars it was.
It was multiple times the revenue, so don't think they'll pay that off on the current revenue stream.
No, and not from Symantec and Carbon Black, but every bit helps.
All right, Amanda, let me get your take on this because, you know, we three old timers are talking about this and I've been following VMware forever. But as you listen to all these financial manipulations, would it inspire you with confidence if you were sitting there thinking about what platforms you were going to be using and who you might want to partner with?
Yeah, I'm not sure. But I mean, we've seen so many different company shifts and plays. I'm not going to say I can predict what's going to happen. So I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen?
All right. Well, I think that was the wisest thing you said in this little segment here.
Yep.
Because the truth of the matter is, and Alan, you can close it out, but in my opinion, these consolidations are, you know, they're part of the game that you're in the IT sector, and everybody that you do business with can be bought by somebody else. And even companies that you would think that are completely untouchable suddenly wind up getting acquired one morning and you're like, holy crap, what are we supposed to do? So it's part of the drama. Alan?
Absolutely. And let me just say this. This merging with Carbon Black and Symantec and potentially selling it, it's not the last we're going to see of sell-offs at Broadcom. I think there will be huge swaths of the VMware business that are going to be sold off, possibly even Tanzu, right?
So are you saying then their promise, but their mention that they're going to invest in R&D is just a ruse?
I think they will invest in R&D in as much as it makes that business more valuable. Right. My question, Bob, is not whether they'll invest in R&D, but is it a long-term investment? I don't think, you know, they're planning on owning Carbon Black and Semantic 2 years from now.
So create a new company called Semantic, Cement Black,
right? Yeah.
Cement Black and
or
sell it off.
Carbon Tech.
All right, Carbon Tech.
I'm not saying this is going on here, but I have seen in the past where there's some funny accounting that goes into R&D dollars. So if I invest $1 and it gets used by six different product companies or six different groups within that company, it gets counted as $6. So
who knows? You know what? As I said in the beginning, they're smarter than we are. Let's see how it plays out, but it bears watching. Hey, that's going to, I think, call it a wrap on today's TechStrong Gang. Bob, I thank you for getting up in the dark wee hours of the LA morning and joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on. Mike, I know you're on the road. You and I will be in Paris next week for KubeCon and doing a lot of Linux Foundation CNCF interviews as they're sponsoring the TechStrong TV program there, so it's going to be great. Amanda, you'll be holding the fort down while we are all out. So do what you got to do, and we'll see you soon. I hope you've enjoyed this TechStrong Gang episode. Don't worry, with Mike and myself and even Mitchell traveling next week, Amanda and Sharon Florentine and the rest of the gang here will be holding down the fort. We'll have TechStrong Gang episodes for you, as we always do, every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday. Until then, though, this is Alan Schimmel for TechStrong. We're out.
Cloud Native Now is the web's leading resource for the growing cloud native ecosystem. CloudNativeNow.com is your destination for news, thought leadership, features, and webinars on cloud native architecture, Kubernetes, serverless, cloud native application development, microservices, service mesh, cloud native security, and more. Stay on the cutting edge of modern application development at CloudNativeNow.